Happy Aloha Friday, everyone. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today, we Hanaho interviews from our recent series highlighting Hawaii's specialty courts. Drug Court is marking three decades, and it's one of the early programs created to give people a second chance at life on the straight and narrow. We learn about the origins of Girls Court and celebrate the contributions of many to help our troubled teens. And have you heard about Women's Court? The island of Hawaii recently launched a program, and the one here on Oahu just graduated its first cohort this summer.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton Event Series presents keiki author Kealani Netane this Saturday at 10 a.m. Kealani will read from her book, Tala Learns to Siva, as well as lead keiki activities for crafting your own ideas and getting your bodies moving. RSVP for this free event at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union, featuring home equity lines of credit. More about HELOC at hawaiistatefcu.com, federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're sharing a Hanaho show about the history and the people behind the specialty courts here on Oahu. Back in 1995, Hawaii took a chance on something called Drug Court to deal with the rising cases of crime around drug abuse. Under the late Chief Justice Ronald Moon, the idea was born to find a better way to deal with those convicted of drug crimes and to reduce recidivism. 30 years later, with the data to show its success, there have been spin-offs. There's now a Veterans Court and Mental Health Court, which sprang out of the desire to do better than just lock people up. Matt Viola is the first circuit court judge in charge of Oahu Drug Court, and Greg Uwano is the administrator for the specialty courts. We talked with the two of them last month about the programs that are in place to deal with the substance abuse issues that are often the underlying reasons why people end up behind bars in the first place.
We're coming up on our 30th anniversary in Hawaii, in the First Circuit at least, with our drug court. And I think over time, that initial idea has proven to be true.
I understand there's something called juvenile drug court as well.
We do. In our family court, we have a juvenile drug court that has been in existence for over 20 years. I happen to have been the presiding judge for that court for a number of years before I became the presiding judge of the drug court in the First Circuit on the adult side. So the approaches are similar, that is to address the underlying causes of their involvement in the system. The dynamics are a little bit different because they are children, of course, and developmentally, they respond in different ways to different kinds of treatment or system approaches. Their families are involved a little more heavily, but same basic idea.
What has been the most gratifying thing for you as you look back at how this was first started and created and the good that it's done?
Oh, I think far and above the most gratifying thing is to see people who succeed in overcoming their great challenges. You know, a lot of our participants have lost some degree of hope. They've created lots of problems for themselves and the people they care about. And with a lot of hard work and interventions and treatment, they start to turn their lives around so that they end up becoming not just law-abiding citizens or net contributors to our system rather than being net takers, but they heal. They heal relationships with their family and their good, productive, law-abiding citizens. We see that very frequently. Not everybody succeeds in these programs. We have a pretty good success rate. Over time, we've graduated probably about 1,200 to 1,300 participants in the Drill Corps program. And ripple effects of that success are enormous. So that's the most gratifying thing, to see individuals succeed and turn their lives around.
You talk about hope, and I remember when Judge started that, the Hope Probation, holding out that light, look, we can do this, we can help you turn your life around and set you on the right path.
What I've come to learn is a lot of the participants in these programs, they're labeled as failures, criminals, drug addicts, and honestly, in the beginning, sometimes those labels are apt. A lot of times the participants see themselves that way, but that's not necessarily who they really are. So over time, they start to shed those labels and they become who they are really meant to be. And that's good for all of us. That's good for our community. It saves us a lot of money. And again, the focus is on really, it's a public safety program, ultimately.
And Greg, I know as a courts administrator, you're juggling a lot of moving parts. What is it that you see with drug court, the value of that?
I see a lot of the connections, reconnections with the community, with their family, all the things that Judge Viola was speaking about, and just seeing them in the community later, thanking us and seeing that they're working and getting back in their lives and having just a life again. Those are the things that makes it worth for us to continue going.
I think the heart and soul of the program is not just the judges who are the presiding judges or C.J. Moon, who was the chief justice at the time the drug court started. They are, of course, critical. It's really the people who do the work on our programs day in and day out, particularly our probation officers, our treatment counselors that we have in drug court, the case managers who work in our mental health court, and our veterans treatment court, which of course focuses on individuals around the criminal justice system who have served our country. We have veteran mentors. Those are typically retired military people who know what our veterans have been through and can guide them through this process. So it's all those people, I think, who deserve the most credit for the success of our programs. We have some really good partners, too, in the community with mental health court. We work closely with the Department of Health Adult Mental Health Division. And like I said, in Veterans Treatment Corps, we have our mentors, but we also work closely with our Veterans Administration. And in Drug Corps, we have a lot of treatment providers who do really fabulous work for our participants.
Greg, is there anything you want to add about those courts, Veterans Court? It sounds like it's almost like a wounded warrior project, right? And there are folks that have been there out in the foxholes, if you will, and know the trauma and know how hard it can be to process that when you come back into regular life, civilian life. And, you know, and then same with the mental health issues. We're seeing so much of that out on the street.
Just to mirror what Judge Viola was saying, and we do have support from Veterans Affairs, the VA, and they've been really supportive, providing a lot of support with providing them with different resources in the community. A lot of the mentors that come back are alumni from the Veterans Treatment Court also, and they also help. So they are a big support for all of this, too.
Well, as we think back about the first 30 years of drug court and then with the emergence of these other specialty courts, what's on tap for the future?
I think we're always looking to grow our programs because I think there are a lot of people who can be served by our programs. We have to do that in a smart and incremental way, and these programs do cost some money, so we have to take that into account. I think one of the issues that we've been focusing on, but we know that many of the people in the criminal justice system, but particularly in our courts, have suffered from some form of trauma in their lives. And that does explain a lot of their behaviors, a lot of the reasons why they've entered into the criminal justice system and need help. So we are trying to focus on building out our trauma responses so that we can, again, address the underlying issues that cause this person to be in this situation in the first place, and then to help them so that when they leave our programs, they will continue to succeed. So I think that's one of our current initiatives. And I think the issue of trauma is true across the board in all of the specialty or treatment courts. We know generally probably about 80% of people in our courts have some form of trauma, often dating back to their childhood. And when that is unaddressed, it leads to worse outcomes.
You know, I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that you want the listeners to understand about these specialty courts.
You know, one thing, I don't know if this is a widespread perception, but some people may think that this is, some of these individuals really should go to jail and go to prison. And there are certainly people, again, who don't succeed in our programs and end up going to jail and prison. But these are not easy programs for someone to participate in. We demand a lot, and a lot of what we demand are some sort of, I guess you would call them old-fashioned values. For our participants, they need to be honest. They need to, if they can work, they need to be gainfully employed. We impose curfews. We make them live in clean and sober houses or living situations. We compel them to participate in their treatment, and not just participate in the treatment, but to succeed in their treatment. We require them to pay off their financial obligations, such as fees, fines, and restitution. These are difficult programs. It is not unusual for new participants who come in to say, this was much harder than I thought. And our focus is to make sure that they, as long as they're living out in the community, that they're living out in the community safely. And if they're not, there will be consequences. We do hold our participants accountable in a lot of ways, including that they can be sent to jail for violations. And we intensively supervise them. They will come to court in the beginning weekly for weekly court hearings. They will report to their probation officers frequently, including weekly or more often if necessary. They will be drug tested very frequently, random drug testing, and that will take place over the course of their participation in the program, at each of these programs, dozens and dozens of times. And the same model applies to the Veterans Treatment Court if the participant has a substance abuse issue. And similarly in mental health court, our mental health court participants, one of the requirements is that they have to suffer from a serious and persistent mental illness that was one of the causative factors for them being involved in the system. And those programs are equally rigorous. So I think to the extent that there's a perception that these are programs where people get to live in the community when they shouldn't be there, that's not correct.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners? Any particular case that really spoke to your heart?
One person I was thinking about recently, she was a participant in our mental health court program. All of our participants have to have some serious persistent mental illness. Many of our participants suffer from schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she lived a very, very hard life. Her mental illness caused her to believe that trees were harassing her, so she would walk around the community with a bicycle helmet to protect herself. She lived on the streets primarily. She was victimized regularly. She had a substance abuse issue with methamphetamine, which is still one of the most common substances of abuse. And so she came, and she had previously been in prison, and she came into our program, and slowly but surely with this team approach, she stayed, right? She got into a treatment program, and she actually finished that residential treatment program. She started getting the right kind of medications, and she took them regularly. Then when she transitioned out of that residential program, she got into group housing. And she graduated from our program having been clean and sober for over a couple of years. She had stable housing. And to me, that was remarkable, close to a miraculous story, because she was one of those people who was lost. And that turnaround in her life was directly attributable to her participation in mental health court and all the work that the people who worked in our program did for her. But one of the things that is most gratifying to me is when our participants in any of the courts reconnect with their families. And many of them have lost connections with their families. And over time, when they turn their lives around, they start to heal those relationships. And I think that is one of the most meaningful things that our participants experience. And for me, it's one of the most gratifying and meaningful things that I can be involved in.
That was First Circuit Court Judge Matt Viola and Specialty Courts Administrator Greg Umano highlighting the programs in place to help get to the root problem of why people often end up in criminal court. Thank you. We've heard about the success of drug court and the other specialty courts that have targeted a cross-section of people behind bars. We recently talked with retired family court judge Karen Radius. She's a founding judge of Hawaii's Girls Court that back in 2004 was a pilot project. It became a permanent program in 2017. Its success in reducing the number of juvenile girls in confinement was featured in a recent Mother Jones article. We also spoke with presiding judge Diane Medeiros and Valerie Lazo, who has worked with Girls Court for 13 years as a probation officer and as program coordinator. Judge Radius starts us off by recalling that in the 1970s, it was rare to see a girl in juvenile court, but then something changed and the numbers soared, exceeding the national average.
We started to look at statistics, and at that point, 43% of the juvenile arrests in Honolulu were girls, compared to a national statistic of about 21% of the juvenile arrests were girls. And there were no specific program for girls. They could get help through Department of Health, sometimes through the Department of Education, but there wasn't a concentrated, specific look at them as the factors that brought them to the juvenile system and how to provide them the opportunities that young women were getting at that point.
You know, I understand that, you know, a few years ago that count went down to zero.
What went down to zero was the number of girls in the Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility, which is often called Ko'olau. There are still girls in the juvenile system, but as far as the for serious offenses, long-term confinement, we don't call it incarceration, but long-term confinement, it was down to zero, and I was there about a year ago. There were only two, so we were happy about that.
Well, what do you think makes what you do work?
I think what makes it work is, one, most of the girls that we would see in the juvenile system, a lot are arrested for runaway, a lot are arrested for not going to school, a lot are arrested for more minor offenses. They're not carrying Uzis to 7-Eleven and holding up gas stations or anything like that. What are the factors that bring them into contact with the juvenile system? And if you look at the amount of early trauma in girls is higher than it is in boys, that affects them, their family lifestyles cause them problems, they aren't getting to school. When they are getting to school, sometimes they're angry and they're getting into fights and other situations at school. And they don't see life as having much of a future. So one of the biggest parts of girls' court is introducing them to women who have accomplished things and introducing them to ways of life that you don't need sex, drugs, and rock and roll at 14. You can learn other things and go back to school, get engaged with the community, get engaged in healthy activities. So we have kids that have gone on to college, including all the way up to master's degrees. We've got kids who've stopped using drugs. We've got kids who have just found a better way of life, less frenetic, and often are the first in their family generationally to not be involved, to stop being involved with court systems and child abuse systems and other less savory things.
So you've broken that cycle?
Yes, in many instances. Not every instance, but many, yes.
And Judge Medeiros, you know, what have you seen? I mean, this program is being held out as a model that, hey, we need to do things better. Let's try something. What does it look like from where you sit today?
I mean, I think that one of the really important facets of girls' court and all of our specialty courts, but one of the things that really makes it work is we try to meet each girl where she is, each youth where they are, and assess what their issues are. Judge Radius is correct in terms of, you know, we see a lot of girls that have lower level offenses, but things have also changed over the last 20 years, or maybe we've just become more aware of differences because Girls Court has done such a good job with girls that have the runaways and stuff like that. We still have them, but we've also kind of uncovered and started trying to help the girls that are victims of sex trafficking, we call them the CSEC, the commercially sexually exploited children. Those girls have much higher needs. And so we kind of juggle both types, but we try to meet each girl where she is, because as Karen was just saying, what is driving the behavior? And that's what we try to figure out. What's driving the behavior, and then how can we address the behavior?
And it sounds like, you know, these programs have been successful because you have been able to identify, you know, whether role models or mentors, people who these young girls can emulate.
Yes, we have. I think everybody in the courtroom is a mentor. We all try to be a mentor and a role model. But we've also, and Val can speak to this because she was a huge part of it, we've also done a lot to build partnerships in the community. Right now we work with an organization, Women Speaking Out, that they're just really a great organization, and they provide a lot of mentoring and a lot of pro-social activities and a lot of opportunities for our girls.
And Val, you jump in here. Like, what have you seen over the years?
I definitely think it mirrors everything that Judge Radis and Judge Medeiros have shared. I mean, when I started with Girls Court, it was a different time. I mean, I was there for 13 years, and although some of the issues are similar, I do think that the girls right now come into Girls Court with very complex lives, more than we can even imagine for some adults when we think about it. But it is important for us to build community partnerships, because in the long run, you know, their time with us is temporary. You know, if they're on jurisdiction with family court, it's not long-term, or the goal is not for it to be long-term. So it's really looking at building a community for them that can be safe, that they can, you know, grow with and learn from in their own, you know, neighborhoods, or, you know, on their own as they move into adulthood and continue their lives, and really to stop the cycle that Judge Radis had, you know, you had asked Judge Radis about too. It's really building a new pathway for them, or helping them see what that is, or, you know, identify or unlock their opportunities.
This is Judge Radis again. We engage the families. The mother or father, grandmother, whoever's the main caretaker, needs to come to court with the child each time the child comes to court, which is usually around once every month. Even if they're doing well, they still have to come to court. And the parents are learning from the other parents, learning from how the probation officer and the therapists are working with the girls. We've also had parents who've had their own prior abuse against them, had drug addiction themselves, come to realize, oh my goodness, if my girl can be getting better, if my girl can be stopping drugs, so can I. And we've had mothers go back to college and get jobs. And so it's family court. It's about the child, but it's also about the family, and not just a what did the kid do wrong and what's the punishment for that.
And I don't know if there is an example that you would like to give of something that really touched your heart when you saw this impactful change happen.
This is Val, if I can jump in really quick.
Yeah, please.
You know, more recently, and Judge Medeiros can attest to this too, but we had a girl that came to us who was definitely in a exploitive type of relationship with a much older man, didn't go to school for 2, maybe even 3 years, was very disconnected with her family. Unfortunately, she was highly addicted to meth and was using ice almost on a daily basis. And, you know, we celebrated her graduation from high school this past year. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty significant because she helped to rebuild her relationship with her grandmother, who was her guardian, as well as, you know, her sister. And, you know, and she does come from a family that has had their own levels of trauma and drug addiction, and she herself is trying to break that cycle. But she is now very much involved in doing work with the community organization that we've partnered up with. She's clean and sober, and she's actually attending community college right now. So that's definitely a success in my book, for a recent success that we've had.
This is Judge Medeiros. Another recent case came to to Girls Court, a lot of trauma history. I can't remember if she was actually confirmed C-sec, but definitely at high risk if not actually confirmed. Domestic violence in her relationship with her boyfriend, just all kinds of things going on. And she was a young lady that I wound up sending to HYCF, to Ko'olau, because every time we put her in any kind of program, she would be assaulting people in the program. And I would go and visit her at DH, talk with her, and try and encourage her. And eventually it got to the point where I did have to send her to HYCF. I don't remember exactly how long she was there. I think it was less than 6 months. But then after that, we were able to put her in another program that she didn't complete. She didn't successfully complete the program 100%, but I would say she probably completed it over 90%. And it was like she was a different person after that. Unfortunately, that was a program on the mainland, but when she came home, she was able to reintegrate into her home. She was able to graduate from high school. She stayed clean. She stopped running away. She stopped basically reconciling with the abusive relationship, and now she's working, and she's just in a much better place, and you can see it when you talk to her. Her attitude and her ideas are just so different, and she was always extremely smart, extremely articulate. I used to tell her all the time, you should go to law school. But that really touched my heart because that was a long road. We had a lot of years with her and it took a long time, but she really did get to a much better place.
We have been hearing from retired family court judge Karen Radius, a founding judge of Girls Court. She's sharing perspective along with presiding judge Diane Medeiros and Val Lazo. Both have many years of experience in Girls Court. Stay with us as we continue with more of our conversation right after a short break.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
This Saturday night on The Real Deal. Anita O'Day, one of the most creative of jazz vocalists, will be our focus. That's Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1. Join me, Seth Marco, as we give a good listen to Anita O'Day.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. With works from around the globe spanning 5,000 years, offering fresh discoveries and new perspectives. HonoluluMuseum.org.
You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Let's get back to our conversation with retired family court judge Karen Radius, presiding judge Diane Medeiros, and Valerie Lazo as we get to learn about an effort in family court to help our troubled teens.
We would love it if we did not have to send anybody to the mainland, number one. You know, we're constantly looking at changing girls' court to improve it, or trying to involve different, come up with different ways to improve it, I guess is the best way to say it, because the girls are constantly changing, right? And life is constantly changing. I mean, the cell phones alone and the social media is huge with our girls. And after COVID, there's just been so many changes with the girls. So one of the things that we've been talking about is Girls Court historically, and I apologize, Karen, you don't know about this yet, but one thing we've been talking about is Girls Court historically has been all women in the courtroom. But I noticed maybe about 6 months ago, that's dependent on the prosecutors and the public defenders being able to have a female prosecutor or public defender in the courtroom. And the prosecutors weren't able to do that. And so they sent a young man, prosecutor, but he was really able to connect with the girls. in the courtroom, and they really listened to him. And I noticed that, and I started thinking, because so many of our girls are in either, they're either in abusive relationships or they have seen that with their mothers, that it would be good for them to have a positive role model that was a man that could talk to them without being scary or threatening or anything like that, and they could interact with him. So that's one of the things we're talking about, is having those kinds of interactions, because they also need to be positive male role models.
Yeah, so you want to meet them wherever you can, right?
Exactly.
I don't know if there's anything that you want to convey to the general public about these programs and where they work and how you're trying to tweak it.
So one of the things is we had our 20th anniversary the fall of last year, and 200 people showed up, not just kids and their parents, but also people who had volunteered with us, people who had been social workers involved in the kids' CPS cases, heads of agencies. It was absolutely wonderful. And some of the girls who came were from our very first cohort of kids. To see them as young women and doing well and being centered with their family was just heartwarming. With various funding cuts that are coming and are coming to nonprofit agencies, we got to stay alive is the first question. And the second question is, people have talked about, well, why isn't there a boys' court? To some extent, drug court has got more boys in it, juvenile drug court, but it's not quite as intensive as girls' court, so working on those things. So not every girl who comes to family court is in girls' court. If it can be handled with smaller amounts of resources, with less complicated cases, so you steal a pack of gum from Walmart, you're not instantly in girls' court. But How do we stay focused to, one, keep us going and having the good track record we've had, and two, molding with the times and what challenges the kids are facing out in the public and in their schools, and as computers and AI and other things get more...
They complicate things.
Complicated, yes.
So I want to follow up on something that Karen was talking about, because actually we have been talking about possibly starting a boys' court recently, modeled after girls' court, in that boys need good role models too. But it would have to be, I think, separate from juvenile drug court, because that's a very specific program. But we are seeing more boys with different needs. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways that we need to look at expanding our programs to help the youth. I think that one thing I would like the community to know is that we rely a lot on our community partnership. I spoke a little bit about women speaking out. One of the other things that I think is just huge, and I think, Karen, you started this with Haleakala, the National Park Service, where every year there's at least one, and in some years we've had two trips to Haleakala, where the National Park Service, not all of the girls in girls' court, but some of the girls will go there, and they'll spend, depending on the trip and depending on whether it's COVID or not COVID, like a weekend or maybe one overnight. But they're in the park and just experiencing the park. They go on hikes. The rangers teach them different things, laymaking, artistic activities. And that's just huge, because a lot of our girls have never even been on a plane before, and they're going on this trip. And I don't know when it started, but it still continues to this day.
That and Surfrider Spirit Session, which is a nonprofit that I'm still on the board of, started with, we needed something for the girls that wasn't sex, drugs, and rock and roll, some other kind of adrenaline rush. And so I asked a woman surfer who had written a book about surfing, can you get a couple of girlfriends, take a couple of my girls out surfing a couple of times? And so that nonprofit is now, oh man, I think about 17 years old. But it has continued, and it continues to see not only court kids, but also other at-risk kids in the community, and go to Waikiki, they get a mentor, they learn to surf, and there's lesson using surf as a metaphor for life, talk about life lessons. You fall off the board, you get back on, you try again, you work hard. That's free recreation outside, not sitting in front of a screen, not being the mean guy in town. And so boys are invited to that also. So it started with all girls, and then the boys were saying, wait a minute, how come the girls get ordered to surf and we don't? And so that was kind of fun.
Well, so it sounds like you had this idea, Judge Radius. We watched it grow, but it is still going strong thanks to the support of the community, of the people who care about our future.
Absolutely. And with the support of Justice Moon was the Chief Justice when it started, and now Justice Rechtenwall, both of those have been supportive. And keeping the support of the Judiciary Administration is important, the support of the other agencies, the support of individuals in the community who say, hey, I can volunteer to do the following, and maybe it's only a one-day thing they can do, or a one activity, or a place that we can meet and have an activity.
Yeah, but it's stepping up to help our young people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you, all three of you, for spending time with us and sharing some of your wisdom about what we need to keep our community healthy and keep our young people thriving.
Thank you for having us.
That was retired family court judge Karen Radius, presiding judge Diane Medeiros, and Valerie Lazo, who has served as program coordinator and probation officer. This story originally aired this past September before Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwall's retirement. Stay tuned. We'll be telling you about women's court next.
Hawaii Public Radio amplifies voices from all across the Hawaiian Islands.
News, Ike Kupuna, Mele Mo'olelo, and more.
All in today's episode of the Hawaii Radio Hour from Kahilu.
From Hawaii Island comes Hawaii Radio Hour, part of our weekend lineup on HPR One and available as a podcast.
As Hawaiians, we live with one foot on this side in the here and the other foot in the hereafter. And for us, the ancestors are present in a real way.
Hawaii Radio Hour is part of our continued commitment to elevate Hawaii's diverse and distinct voices. Support Hawaii Public Radio's commitment to local programs. Become a monthly supporter by clicking donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. If you're just joining us, we're re-airing segments from our series about the judiciary's specialty courts. Women's Court began in 2023 as a pilot program in the First Circuit here on Oahu. This past legislative session, lawmakers made the program permanent and are hoping to copy its success on the island of Hawaii. A women's court launched there this past September. We had a chance to talk to First Circuit District Court Judges Mark Browning and Trish Morikawa about why it's important to offer these programs. Browning starts us off.
I served in family court both as a district family court judge and then later as the senior judge of family court. One of the fundamental things that we saw in family court, and they still see, are it's sort of the epicenter where you see the most pressing issues that we face as a community, whether it be violence or domestic violence, drugs, mental health, all those different things. And I was really fortunate in the 90s when I started that I was able to have mentors who taught me that one of the things that a judge has to do and should be doing is keeping track of how the system is working to adjudicate those issues, but more importantly, to try to find out and notice where the system is not working. And we saw that fundamentally in a different ways. And a perfect example of that is girls' court. When we started to look in the early 90s at the data that showed that the incarceration of girls was way above the national average as opposed to in Hawaii, as opposed to what incarceration rates for males was at the time, which was far below the national average. And so, you know, one of the individuals who was very fundamental to helping us understand these principles was Judge Wong, Frances Wong. And she taught us, and it's a lesson that I took to heart, that judges can act as a catalyst to make changes and to systems to make a difference. You know, when we started with our specialty courts in family court, with juvenile drug court, as well as girls court, we sort of started on this path. And I was appointed as the presiding judge of the juvenile drug court and had the privilege of serving as the presiding judge for 8 years. And as a result of that, learned how effective specialty courts could be. With respect to how women's court started, I had that idea in my head. I became chief judge of circuit court in, I think, about 2017. And there were a lot of things that I wanted to do and things that I wanted us to improve on. And I got a good start at that, and then COVID hit and brought everything to a standstill. So towards the end of COVID, after we got the court sort of operating again, at least given the circumstances that we were facing that time, I started doing some research about women who were incarcerated in our prisons, having learned those lessons in family court. When I started looking at the data was pretty startling, and it was very consistent with what we saw with respect to the genesis of girls' court. And the data basically showed that, and I can't remember specifically all the data, but I do remember that the data showed that the rate of incarceration for women in the last 20 years at that particular point had increased about 1,000% compared to men, which was just 20%. Then we started looking a little bit closer. We looked and found that the pathways for women into the situation, getting themselves into to prison, were different than for males. And that meant that there were more issues of domestic violence, more issues of substance abuse, more issues of family dysfunction, more issues of prior sex abuse. And so once I got that information and had a moment to start working on this, I started the process of talking to the Chief Justice. And Chief Justice Rechtenwald had always been very supportive of all the initiatives that I'd started. And so I asked him if this would be something that he would want us to pursue, and he was very, very supportive.
Judge Morikawa, I mean, you folks were able to celebrate the first graduates. So talk about what that was like, knowing that you'd come this far.
We always knew it was going to happen. You know, we go in saying it's going to happen, but we were still very excited that it actually did, you know, because it was our first class. And with it being new, you just don't know. So we were super excited. The women all wanted to be part of that first class. And some of the women, when they came in, they said from the beginning, we want to be the first graduating class. We want to show that we can do this and that this program is helping us. And it worked. And so we were just so grateful that we had all the support that we had and that the women were so on board. Everyone had to go through substance abuse treatment. So that varied depending on the individuals. I think most had been in some sort of form of residential treatment and then outpatient treatment. So they all had to do substance abuse treatment. So that's an outside provider that helped us with that. And then a number of them also have different forms of mental health treatment, be it psychiatrist, a psychologist, therapist. So a number of them were doing therapy in some way, shape, or form. And again, that's through the outside providers that are assisting us. They all had to obtain stable housing. They all had to either work or go to school or have a disability that didn't allow them to work or go to school. So they all had to do that. They all had to complete our women's court requirements that were set up by the legislature. So the legislature required the program to provide information to the women in regard to work, education, health. There is a variety of requirements, and our staff put together a program. It's a 12-month program. It has 12 units, so one unit a month, and they have to complete that unit and take a test to say that they passed it. And so they had to complete all 12 of those units, along with having to stay clean and sober for, you know, each phase of the program requires different things, but generally everything that I just said is the requirements that they have to do, along with meeting their probation officers, meeting their case managers, coming in and doing drug testing.
Yeah, it's one step at a time, right?
Right.
Just holding their hand, getting through to the next level. And then what about, you know, now, like once they're graduated?
Once they're graduated, technically with probation, once somebody is off of probation, we are technically, I guess the way the rules are, we're not supposed to contact them. But we did for our women, and we asked if they would be willing to sign basically a waiver that would allow us to contact them after. So they all did. And so our thoughts are that, well, our plan is to reach out to them 3, 6, 9, and 12 months after to check on them. And then yearly after that to also check criminal histories on everybody. So our first 3 months comes up, I think, in like 2 weeks. So we actually are just in the process of making sure that we're all in agreement on the questionnaire that we're going to give out to them. And then we're going to start following up and seeing how they're doing. So we have been in contact with a bunch of them. Sometimes they'll call, sometimes they come around. We have been reaching out to a few because people, organizations, or things have been wanting to find out more about women's court. So they've been gracious enough to come and talk. So, yeah, we're following up. As far as we know, they're doing well.
Judge Browning, do you want to jump in here? You know, I mean, the fact that this has gotten off the ground here on Oahu, you have your first cohort, and now you're looking to help there on the Big Island.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's happened in the history, especially courts, is, you know, the judiciary is divided up in circuits. So we're the first circuit. You know how that is in terms of different circuits, but every circuit is in and of itself semi-autonomous. So when we have started the specialty courts, we have been able to show with the various different successes we've had that it is something that will work and does work. And therefore, one of the things we try to do is we try to speak to our brethren on the neighbor islands, and they're very interested in some of these projects. If they are at a particular point where they have the resources to start it, they will often come over and train or just observe and decide whether it meets the needs of their community, and the Big Island apparently has. And I think that, you know, one of the things about the different specialty courts on the neighbor islands is it's got to be built specifically for the circumstances that exist within that particular community. And so the Big Island Women's Court will probably be a little bit different from what Oahu looks like. But in essence, the values and the sort of structure that has been built around women's court will be the same.
Just the whole idea, if you can break a cycle, right, if you can help with the parenting skills and then you help with
right.
the next generation, because it's not just for these women, but for their children.
Yeah, and it's also, that's a really important point, because one of the things that I failed to mention was part of the data showed that, you know, as a result of the way that we were incarcerating women, and particularly women who were nonviolent, is one of the results was that it was adversely affecting children. Because you're taking a parent away, irrespective of what that condition of that family is, that's very traumatic for those children. And they end up becoming victims, in a sense, because they end up, in many instances, in the CPS system. We're not giving up accountability. Accountability is very important. We understand that. But the success in terms of giving back to the community somebody who has been able to get healthy and get the support system that will make them successful and contributing members to our community is so far, in terms of cost, is so much better for our community than the outcome the other way.
We've been hearing from First Circuit Court Judges Trish Morikawa and Mark Browning. They were talking about the success of women's court here on Oahu. That story originally aired in September. And that does it for us for today's Hanaho Show on the Specialty Courts. We hope it gives you a different dimension about the work underway in our judiciary. Have feedback for the show? Share it with us. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, and you can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HBR Digital team. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.